Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we have David Corio online. Are you there, David? Are you there, David?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, so the button wasn't pushed here. So, we've been playing some Dennis Brown. We've been playing some Prince Lincoln. And I told the people about your website. And so they know a little. Maybe they don't know as much as you can tell them. But, David, haven't seen you in a long time. Good talking to you the other day. Please give my listeners a rundown, and we're on the World Wide Web also, of who you are and what you've done in reggae music.
Right, okay. So, well, a quick bio, I suppose. I started taking photographs, I mean, specifically reggae, in about 1978, something like that. So, and really sort of carried on sort of photographing reggae musicians ever since, you know, give or take a few years when I was doing other things, but so, you know, really photographed, you know, most of the musicians that have been with us in that time. I mean, there's always a few that unfortunately miss out on, but you know, I sort of started off in London. There was, you know, always a big reggae scene there,
right?
And I've lived in New York for about the last 14 years, so, you know, most of the pictures I've taken have been in either London, New York, or, you know, in Jamaica. So, you know, I try and get down to Jamaica at least once every couple of years, if not, you know, more frequently. So, and, you know, I think it's just the love of the music. You know, that's why it's something that, you know, it's nice to photograph your heroes, basically. So any opportunity I've got, you know, I've always, you know, gone out of my way to just try and, you know, photograph those people anyway.
And you were about 18 when you...
Yeah. So about, probably, I mean, actually, probably the first sort of gigs I went to were probably about 16 in about 1976.
But, wow.
You know, but then, yeah, really sort of, you know, seriously photograph. I used to do work when I was about 18 for New Musical Express in London. So, you know, I was photographing all, anyone, you know, all sorts of music. I mean, it's not just reggae.
Right.
People, but, but, you know, reggae's always been my real love anyway. So, but yeah, I think like Misty and Roots, they were about probably the first people, the first reggae band I photographed, which was, you know, probably 77, 78. And then I think Jacob Miller actually was the first in about 1979 when he came over to London, you know, with Inner Circle. And, you know, that was just something, it was just such a memorable gig. I mean, he was just such a brilliant performer, you know. I mean, there was like so much energy there, and he was just, you know, just had that really distinctive voice that you know, just really stood out. And I think, you know, that's probably you know, someone that really had a sort of a major effect on me, thinking, oh, you know, I better start buying some serious vinyl here, you know, just to find out what's going on, you know.
Right. And you think he was only 25 when he died. I mean, amazing.
No. Yeah, it's really, that was tragic, really, because, I mean, he had, you know, so much, just so much energy going on there, you know, not just on stage, but, I mean, just musically in general, I think, you know, his, you know, yeah, another person that, certainly another reggae singer that, you know, parted way too early, you know.
Yeah, man.
Really sad, you know. But he certainly left us with some good tunes, though, at least. So, you know, that's one good thing to say for him anyway.
Well, you know what I've been doing? I just turned it off now. Is I've been playing some of your favorites of Dennis Brown, 12-inch, that I don't know if you remember, but quite a while ago, you sent me some tapes, and one of them was Dennis Brown 12 inches, and some rarities, because a couple of the DJ versions I have never heard before. So
right.
So
which ones were they? I didn't, because I
oh, In His Own Way.
Yeah.
And Big Youth was doing the DJ version, and that's, I don't even know the DJ on the next one. But you'll get a copy of this definitely, this show. And I put some Prince Lincoln on, and I cut him off. One song, I put on your song, Humanity, live, Prince Lincoln live. So,
oh, right, nice.
Yeah, so you really like that. And the thing is that I say you have a connection is because if you take pictures of people, especially if you're doing album covers, you have met many people, and you've probably met them, and you've learned a little bit about temperaments, and I'm sure you have some stories about some photo shoots.
Oh yeah.
you know, and you get to realize, I guess when you're shooting the pictures, you get to realize these guys or women are nothing but human beings.
Right, exactly.
And yeah. we hold them as idols, and it's like, wow.
Right, no, definitely, yeah. It's noticeable a lot more in reggae that, you know, people are a lot more humble, you know. I mean, they come from, you know, normally sort of pretty, you know, poor background. There's a different vibe to the majority of them, certainly, compared to
Barry Manilow. I remember you told me about that project of Barry Manilow album.
That was one. Yeah, I wouldn't mind forgetting. But yeah, no, he's certainly, you know, some of these people have got such huge egos that it's more of a battle. You know, you don't get to really capture their personality, whereas with, you know, certainly the majority of reggae musicians, I think, you, particularly if you know them and you like their music as well, you know, it certainly helps. And they'll open up as well if you, you know, I mean, I always try and, you know, talk to people about what they're doing and, you know, what they've done. And once you, you know, sort of drop a few titles of songs, you know, when they realize that you actually sort of know something about them, that always helps, certainly. You know?
Right.
But, I mean, it's, there's very few sort of reggae musicians, I must say, that I've ever had a hard time with. You know, the majority are, you know, just good fun and just, you know, nice to hang out with, you know, as you know as well, anyway.
Yes. And you love, of course, Jah Shaka.
Yep.
Can you tell the listeners something you expressed to me one time about, because I think, I don't know if you showed up at that show at SOB's, but he had a fair amount of speakers, but I think you mentioned to me that it's nothing like what it would be like at a Shaka session in England. Could you tell the listeners what kind of feeling and vibe that would be like?
Yeah, sure, yeah. I mean, Shaka was someone I really sort of followed from sort of really as soon as I started getting into reggae, living in London. He would play out every weekend at least, if, you know, not sort of two or three times a week. So, you know, there was always an easy opportunity to go and see him. And normally, like, the whole setup would be, it would normally start at around sort of midnight, something like that, but probably not get going properly till about sort of 2 a.m. or so.
Mm-hmm.
But the boxes, I mean, the speakers would be probably at least sort of, you know, 12 foot high and, you know, virtually square, and you would often get them, if it was in a sort of large, he'd often play in like little community centres and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just be, you know, literally every wall space would be covered in these boxes, so you'd be sort of standing in the middle, you know, you couldn't escape basically. And you'd always know that he was playing before you even got there. You'd hear, you know, down the street you'd hear you know, sort of this sort of, you know, booming sound.
Right.
You'd hear, like, all the window frames would be sort of rattling, and then you just get inside. And it would be more, as much as a, I mean, obviously an oral thing, but you would feel it so much as well. I mean, it would be, I always remember, you just feel it in your stomach, just like this sort of, you know, the heavy bass sort of vibrations. And I remember, like, my kneecaps felt as they were vibrating, you know. And his shows, you'd get every sort of person there. I mean, really, everyone was seeing a guy with one leg dancing on crutches. Like an old Hasidic Jewish guy, sort of, you know, sort of dancing away. There'd always be a few, about 3 or 4 Sikhs that would stand right next to him, sort of watching, you know, all his moves.
And, amazing.
Yeah, because he only ever plays with one deck as well, or, you know, used to. I think when he played over here, you know, he was sort of doing, you know, using newer technology, but It was just like this, almost looked like an old sort of 78, sort of, you know, one of those really old sort of decks from the 1960s or something, you know, held together with sort of gaffer tape and stuff. but incredible. Just the and the tunes it dropped, you know, would be just unbelievable. And, you know, you'd never really, half of them, never know what they were, but I mean, it would just go into this sort of sonic bass sound with, you know, nothing but bass sometimes, and you just get into this groove. It was, you know, a real one of those sort of meditational things that you just sort of, once you got into the groove, it was just sort of there, and you'd finally sort of crawl out at about 7 or 8 in the morning and you know, be exhausted until the next week when there was another Jacket gig anyway. But yeah, I followed him until I moved over here, really. I mean, I support, you know, really, would go and see Shaka at least once a month anyway, probably until, you know, from about 78 till 92. So, yeah, about 14 years or so. But yeah, those, the New York shows, they were terrible. I mean, it was really, for me anyway, it was just,
right.
You know, it wasn't happening, you know. But not due to him, but it was just, you know, the venue and the sound, you know, it just wasn't really there.
Yeah, they couldn't do it like they, as you have seen him.
Yeah,
before.
Although I just heard, actually, that he just had all his sound gear stolen out of a truck outside of his house. So apparently, that's what I heard over Christmas anyway.
Oh, my God.
So hopefully, if I'd been returned or, his, you know, managed to get some stuff back together again. Hopefully it wasn't his music anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm vibing, Shaka, because I think it was day before yesterday, I got a DVD in the mail from my friend in Georgia who sent me, it was a Shaka DVD, and it had Michael Prophet, and by the way, I started the show off with Michael Prophet and then the Yavi Youth, the version.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
It was Michael Prophet and Prince Allah, and then those two artists with the sister band backing them up.
Right.
And amazing video. I got to make a copy and send it back to him. But, you know, I haven't seen Michael Prophet in a long time.
Right.
And when I interviewed Earl 16, he was telling me that Michael Prophet is still doing well, you know, doing it over there.
Right.
You know, and, you know, though I would love for that kind of sound system to come over here, but you know, it's just Americans and even Jamaicans, I don't think, over here, not in the same way it is over there.
Yeah, dub has always been, you know, really, I think, you know, sort of dub was probably more popular in England, you know, than in Jamaica, you know, even at its peak. I mean,
mm-hmm.
There were a lot of dub albums released, you know.
Right.
Certainly
right.
Catering for a largely sort of British audience, or certainly European anyway.
Definitely, you know. European audience.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, Shaka, he'll sort of often have sort of people, you know, come and chat on his sound, and, you know, people that you don't expect to be, certainly not DJs, you know, but singers. I mean, I've seen Johnny Clark a few times with him, and Willie Williams, let's see, who else? Well, you know, anyone that was sort of passing through with, you know, that rootsy sort of vibe would, you know, always like acknowledge Shaka, and would certainly, you know, I mean, sort of come along and support. They may just be, you know, there at the sound. I mean, I saw Dennis Brown at sort of Shaka gigs before, you know, not sort of participating other than, you know, just having a dance, you know.
Right.
Which is nice, you know, it's nice to see that sort of support, you know, just for, you know, just respect really for each other's music, you know.
Would you say Dennis is one of your favorite artists?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think I've photographed him a lot over the years. I mean, probably about, I mean, loads of concerts, but I've photographed him in person probably about, I don't know, 10, 12 times, something
mm-hmm,
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I got to know him quite well, and I used to live near him in North London. He used to live sort of down the road, so I'd sort of bump into him sort of quite a lot as well. So he was like the friendliest, just, you know, really. So I would say him and Curtis Mayfield are probably the two sort of nicest people I've ever photographed, I think, you know.
Wow.
Really.
Wow.
You know, just something really special about them, you know.
I think people should hear that, you know, because, you know, they've heard all of the negative stuff about Dennis, and, you know, about some of the problems that he might have had.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And the thing is that other people have some of the problems, but their personality was not like Dennis, because Lauren Drummond told me the same thing.
Right,
that Dennis was really a sweetheart.
Yeah, and always had a smile on his face, you know, always laughing, and just really generous, you know. I mean, the first time I met him was at A&M when he'd just had that, what was it, Love Has Found Its Way had sort of come out, and he was just sort of hanging out. I hung out with him for, you know, often sort of those photo sessions, you know, they may only last sort of, you know, 10 minutes or, you know, even less sometimes, but I probably hung out with him for about an hour and a half. It was just sort of him and you know, sort of him and one other guy just sort of hanging out, you know, but it was just really nice and relaxed, you know. And each time from then on, it was always the same. He always had time for people. And that really upset me, actually. There was, you know, a lot of sort of negative criticism about him, you know, when he died and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think people sort of lost the actual sort of direction of, you know, what he's really should be remembered for, you know, which was bringing, you know, so much sort of brilliant music to us, you know. I mean, it's, I have various arguments with people about sort of him and...
And so let's get back to Dennis again. So you want to say that about Dennis? Because I think it's important what we were talking about before.
Right, sure, yeah. So are you playing music now, or you want me to carry on about Dennis? Or?
Yeah, carry on about Dennis, because I'm going to play some Dennis after we do
thing. Okay, yeah. Well, I just think, you know, I mean, they always sort of, you know, he was always called like the Crown Prince of Reggae, you know, was like this sort of title that was, you know, bestowed upon him. But, you know, to me, I mean, certainly in Jamaica and, you know, any sound system you go to even now, they'll drop sort of Dennis Brown tunes that will be as fresh as now as they were when they were made, you know. And just the sort of longevity of his career, you know, the variety of songs that he did. And, you know, he went from, you know, the heaviest sort of roots tunes to the sweetest lovers tunes to, you know, some great soul covers to, you know, really across the board. And, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, don't really, you know, respect him as much as they should have done, really, you know.
Well, he's one of my favorite singers, you know. And you know, it's like, and it's a funny thing, two of my favorite singers, they're like Sugar and Salt.
Right, right.
And, you know, and you know who the other one is? Gregory, of course.
Right, yeah. Yeah, no, they were quite a pair together. You know,
I'm sure.
Yeah, I did one thing with, the last time I photographed Dennis was like a couple of, probably about 3 or 4 months before he died, actually. And I had a studio on 14th Street.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
He just came up there with his brother and just brought this little beat up old acoustic guitar with him. And you know, by then I sort of knew him well, and he didn't look ill, you know, he was in really good form as always. So I was sort of just getting him, you know, sort of posing with this guitar, and I said, oh, you know, sing some of the tunes that really sort of you know, were a major effect on, you know, your early career. And he just sat down. He must have played guitar and sung about at least 10 tunes.
Wow.
None of them reggae. They were all like mainly sort of Nat King Cole, you know, old, you know, sort of soul stuff like Just by the Dells and stuff like, you know, he was really into his old sort of, you know, 60s soul and stuff. And it was beautiful. I mean, his voice was in good form. And
oh man, David, you got it. With the fact that you just said that, there's something that I've been saying for the longest time, and maybe people think I'm nuts, but you know, Dennis started when he was really a kid, and he's been listening, like as all Jamaicans listen. But when I hear some of Dennis's intonation, you know, the way he sounds, and he reminds me and makes me think that he was listening to Tom Jones.
Right, oh, I'm sure, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
So but, I'm not, I mean, crazy now.
On the album, what's it, Soul and Reggae Hits? That version of Wichita Lineman he does, of, you know, Glenn Campbell's Wichita Lineman, it's, you know, that's a killer version, I think.
Serious,
anyway, you know,
serious.
And how many, you know, reggae artists would be able to do that, you know?
Wichita
Lineman. And he was, what, 13 or 14 at the time?
Yeah, man, how many people know that, you know?
Yeah,
man. So you're a collector too also, David?
Oh, yes, yes.
You got to come this way, man, and check out my archives, man.
Yeah, but I understand I've got a Lincoln Thompson tune you haven't got, so...
right?
Zion, yeah.
Right, and then we could trade up with this live Lincoln Thompson. Getting back to Vivian, I'm going to say something else about Vivian, because I think she's a special person, you know. And last time I saw it was at that leap year birthday party of yours.
Right, okay, yeah. No, I saw her a couple of weeks ago anyway, so she's still in good form anyway, you know, but still doing her writing and everything, you know, but I think she's doing well.
Please hail her up for me.
I will, definitely.
And you want to say something about Augustus Pablo, because you are known to have some really great pictures of him.
Yeah, Pablo was, I mean, well, again, another really sort of special person. I mean, you know, when you're, you know, there's some people that you just, you know, you walk into a room or they walk into a room and you feel like a special presence has sort of joined you almost, you know, and Pablo was one of those. He was, you know, very quiet and, sort of very sort of small in stature. You know, he didn't, you wouldn't have thought that he was sort of like someone who would have that, you know, immense influence over so many people in the way, you know, musically and creatively. But he just sort of really had such a, you know, a real sort of honest sort of vibe to him. And certainly someone very special, very quiet.
I met him in 1985 in Brooklyn at the, you know, the Labor Day, you know, the reggae night.
Right.
And just looking at him, he looks like such a shy, you know, people said, well, no, I won't say I'm shy. I used to be when I was a little boy. Just looking at his eyes.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. No, even, I mean, photographing him, it was sort of quite rare that he'd actually make eye contact, you know? He's just that sort of person that, you know, he didn't really like being photographed that much. He was all right with it, but, wouldn't go out of his way. But, he didn't sort of look for fame or anything. You know, he was sort of very much, you know, as a lot of producers are, really, more sort of behind the scenes.
Right.
I only saw him live once in London. But,
in London, huh?
Yeah, with Junior Delgado and with Chin. I mean, it had a great band, you know, but Junior Delgado was singing, did a sort of a set with Pablo, just sort of, you know, on keyboards and melodica, and then Pablo did a set on his own. And that was, you know, one of the best shows I've ever been to, I think. You know, it was like, they were all on fire, you know, really. And it was at the Astoria, a pretty small maybe about sort of 1,500 sort of people or something there, you know. So it was intimate enough that you really felt, you know, something special, you know. So, a real special person, actually. I mean, again, another sad loss. I met his widow and his one of his sons and his brother Garth actually in Jamaica last year, and sort of gave them a few photographs anyway, but you know, they were obviously still really upset, years later that, you know, he's no longer with us.
Yes man,
again, you know, at least he did bring us and, you know, leave us with some, you know, brilliant music, I must say. You know, I have a melodica in my front room, but I never dare attempt to play it. You know? I wish I could, but there's no use pretending anyway.
Well, I'd like to say this, David, that anybody, if they know about Heartbeat Records, you did a whole, and that's just one record company,
yeah.
Lots and lots of pictures. And so if people, you got any Heartbeat, pull it out, look at the photo credits and you'll see Mr. Corio's name.
yeah, quite a lot of Michael Rose and Blender and Spear and stuff, yeah. So, they do well, you know, they sort of release some good stuff and some nice Studio One compilations stuff, you know, so.
And they're doing it again. I just heard that they were about to re-release or put out some new Studio One, like the some of the same stuff with extra cuts on it.
Yeah, that's right. Like three volumes, all those best ofs, I think. You know, and they've put some extra tunes on, so they should be coming out in the next few months, I think. So.
Well, I'm gonna email Chris Williams.
Chris Wilson, yeah.
Chris Wilson, right? Put me on that list, Chris.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
David, we can't leave without you talking about you and your wife. The book that you co-authored.
Right.
Okay. Well, wait, no, before we do that, we talked about Vivian, but we didn't talk about Black Chords. Can you talk a little bit about that? Just a little bit, tell the people about Black Chords, if they...
It was, I've known Vivian for, since the late 70s, I suppose, so from back in London days. She was another Shakira aficionado as well, but... Yeah, it was really, I mean, I was just sort of going through my archive after, you know, probably 20 years or so, and I've been photographing all sorts of music, but all sorts of black music in particular over the years. It just really dawned on me sort of one day that it's like, well, I, you know, ought to really just try and put these all together, you know, in some form or other. So it was really just sort of, you know, I started realizing that it was, you know, there were all these links. I mean, it was, you know, fairly obvious, but even photographically, there were all these links of different, you know, black music, from, you know, African drummers to, you know, Nyabingi drummers, and then it was, think you'd be looking at, you know, hip hop stuff, and it's like, well, you know, a lot of these hip hop, you know, rappers were either of Jamaican descent or certainly, you know, major influences from sort of reggae and stuff, and it all, and then, you know, sort of jazz obviously influenced reggae, and there were all these different ties, you know, that it only started dawning on me when I was really, you know, laying out maybe, you know, 100 or so pictures that I'd taken of different musicians. So I sort of was chatting with Vivian about it, and we just decided to, you know, see if we could, you know, create a book of some sort anyway of my photographs, and then her, you know, she's interviewed hundreds of different musicians over the years, you know, from all sorts, from Bob Marley to Fela Kuti to, you know, hip-hop people, you know, really across the board. So it just worked, and it was just one of those sort of, you know, it was a sort of organic thing where it didn't seem to take any work in a way. It just, that it all seemed to, you know, fit in almost.
It flowed, it just flowed.
Yeah, total flow, yeah. We could have done with another 100 pages or so, but, you know, but it was, no, it was, you know, it was nice to get it out and actually see them all sort of there, and it was nice to be able to, you know, sort of put in photographs of, you know, people like Alton Ellis and, you know, people that deserve to be acknowledged by, you know, a much wider audience than, you know, a lot of them really have been. So,
right.
So, you know, I wanted to, you know, obviously there were photos of Dennis and Bob and stuff. It was nice to put in, you know, photos of lesser known people, lesser known to, you know, a lot of people anyway. So, yeah, it was something that, you know, we were both sort of, you know, pleased that we'd sort of finally done it. We'd like to actually update it a bit and do another one, but it's a lot of work, you know, just trying to track people down, you know.
Man, it was, you know what, I'm grateful that I have a copy, and, you know, it's a privilege. And I would tell people, can you tell people how they can, where they can look?
Yeah, I mean, I think now it's not sort of so readily available. It came out in 1999, so I think you can still sort of track it down on Amazon, you know, or some of these book searches. But it was published by Universe.
So it's not a big heavy printing.
It sold pretty well, and but I know there were sort of, I mean, now bookstores and stuff, they only leave books, you know, current books on the shelves for, you know, 3-4 months at the most, and then they're, you know, if they haven't all sold out, they're just sort of stuck in a warehouse. So there were certainly some that are probably still floating around anyway, but it's not something you see on the shelves too often. But,
and it's simply called The Black Chords.
Yeah, The Black Chords, C-H-O-R-D.
Right.
It's Universe is the publisher. So.
But now we move on to you and your wife's collaboration.
Right, yeah, that was totally different subject matter, but another sort of addictive thing anyway. It's, it's called Megaliths.
Say that again?
The book was called Megaliths.
Megaliths. Yeah, oh, okay.
Which basically means large stones. And we went around, I was photographing, and Langer was basically collecting all the folklore of all the prehistoric stones in England and Wales, and the stone circles. Like Stonehenge is the,
okay,
you know, is the best known one, really.
Okay.
But there's actually thousands. And, you know, all over Europe, but in particular England, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland, and Brittany, actually. But so yeah, we did a book. I think there were about 75 or 80 different places in the book, and yeah, it was just a compilation of England and Wales. We didn't even sort of start on Ireland or Scotland because they deserve their own books in themselves. But and just really sort of what people thought of them over the years, you know, over the centuries. They've been regarded as, you know, temples of the sun, druid temples, and everyone has their own theories, you know, whether they were for, you know, like astronomers or you know, sacrificial sites or whatever. So no one really knows, basically. No one knows who put them up. They're really the oldest sort of man-made architecture in, you know, in, well, certainly in Europe anyway.
Wow.
They sort of date back, in Ireland, the oldest are over 4,000 BC, so you're looking at, you know, 6,000 years old.
That's
so,
some serious old...
Yeah, serious. Wow. Way older than the pyramids or anything like that, you know?
Indeed.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's another addiction that is... we've also done Ireland as well, covered Ireland really... pretty thoroughly as well, so we're currently working on an Irish volume of that as well.
So and all these can be getting on Amazon. You can,
yeah, that is you can still get that definitely on Amazon. That's called Megaliths, Megaliths, and it was published by Jonathan Cape, which is part of Random House.
Okay, and your wife's name is?
Her name, well, I pronounce it Langer, but it's actually spelled L-A-I, and then...
L-A-I, ah,
yeah,
okay.
And then new word, N-G-A-N.
Okay.
So, Chinese, Malaysian, so... but no one can pronounce it, basically.
Hey, you got any gray hairs since I seen you last?
A few more, unfortunately, yeah. Don't mention it, please.
Yeah, don't mention it, huh? I was just thinking about it. I said, damn, since I went to that party, I know I've gotten grayer since I see
it. Yeah. I think the spinning bit on the top is getting bigger as well.
Well, and I talked to Bobby, too, and I know she's gotten grayer. I don't even have to see her. I know she's gotten grayer. And it was a great interview, Clive, last week with Clive. And
right, yeah, I just spoke to him, actually, an hour or so ago.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's well. So.
And people that listened to it said it was really a good interview. I mean, the wealth of knowledge that guy has, man. You
sure,
know.
Yeah.
I love him. I love him.
Yeah, no, he's
around. No, I mean, he deserves more publicity than, you know, but we're not going to get into that. I will always big Clive Chin up.
Yeah, no, definitely. Much undervalued, I think, in the reggae world. You know, he should be certainly up there with, you know, the bigger sort of, the names that are better known.
Anyway, yeah, man. You know? Yeah, man. Hello? Yeah, that was your phone.
Yeah, I don't know. Getting a crackle in there.
Well, listen, I think we got out a lot of stuff today. I think the listeners are a little bit more familiar with David Corio. And,
right, thank you.
And do you have any projects, any kind of projects you're working on? You always are working on projects.
Yeah, well, I'm actually just trying to finish off a reggae book, actually, of all my sort of reggae photographs. So that's, you know, it's hard to know where to stop. That's the problem. But I was in Jamaica, well, last year, and sort of managed to sort of grab a whole bunch of sort of people that I hadn't photographed in the past, like, you know, Yabby Yu and... Mm-hmm. Max Romeo and Liverpool.
Oh, you saw all those guys down there.
Yeah,
you?
Loads. Kid Asai as well. Hung out with Kid Asai for a day and Pablo Moses. So, yeah, I had a great time. Managed to fit in about 20 odd people in about 10 days. So
wow.
So yeah, that's. I'm just going to sort of hopefully do it just with really just like a few anecdotes. You know, a little bio of everyone and a few anecdotes of, you know, various. You know, fun times I had with all the different people. So that's what I'm currently sort of working on. But who knows what else?
Well, I certainly would love a copy of that book when it comes out.
Yeah. Oh no, you'll definitely be getting one. You'll be on the top of the list, Charles.
And then you know, I'm working on a book too. You know, brother.
Oh really?
Yeah, and it's not been put all together yet, but it's like in theory right now.
Right.
And I've talked to some people, and they are interested in what, you know, some ideas that I have about a book, because, you know, I think I'm a pretty unusual fellow.
Right, oh, you certainly are. One of the kind.
You know, I look at it and I think back on it, David, and I say, I remember, never forget, 1979 when I was out in Queens, and when I met Keith Hudson, actually, I was working with basically all black Americans, and I would put on, I'd have my radio with me, and I was locking up, and I put on reggae, and they would say, yo, man, why don't you put on BLS?
Right, I know.
I'm like,
no taste.
No taste, man. And BLS was the furthest thing from my mind.
Right.
Where you from, brother? You know, that's what they, the next question. But we, and then what threw them off, if I told them I was from Harlem, I'm an African American, that really threw them off.
Right, you know?
Yeah. I know, yeah. Well, and then Cleon Douglas says it, matter of fact, I said, well, you know, the music wasn't promoted in the African American community. He says, that's not it, man. He said, they just didn't like the music.
Right, yeah, I know, yeah.
Well, there's a little bit of truth to both of those things, man.
Right, no, so. True, yeah. Well, it never got the exposure, I don't think.
Well, I think that's the main thing, the exposure.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with it, you know, as much because I was, you know, hearing, you know, going to punk gigs in the, you know, sort of 1976, 1977 in London, and, you know, there was always reggae being played, you know, in between the bands. They'd always play, you know, hardcore reggae. And I don't know why exactly. I mean, it's Don Letts sort of started that, really, but all the DJs would, you know. So, you was getting to hear, you know, and that was really, you know, probably some of the peak years of reggae.
Now, let me ask you, David, were these early punkers, were they the right-wing punkers or... That used to like the music, or were they the left-wing punkers? And the reason I ask you that is because Larry said when he went to Germany with I guess it was the Slackers or Rocksteady 7, it's amazing to see guys with a swastika and a Jamaican flag.
Right.
It's like,
a bit wrong there.
Yeah. How do you respond to that? I mean, so...
Right. Yeah. Confused people, I think. You know, to be honest, the punk scene... in London then wasn't racist at all.
Okay.
But there were elements of, there was a weird racism when it actually came to like the two-tone period, when it was, you know, actually getting more reggae and, you know, ska and types of ska anyway. That tended to bring a skinhead audience that was just, tended to be, not all of them certainly, but you know, a surprisingly large amount would be just real, you know, sort of racists, and it was just like such a bizarre hypocrisy that, you know, you'd have these sort of racists listening to, you know, Jamaican music. So,
wow, what an irony.
yeah, so I mean, I think they were just young and confused, to be honest, more than anything.
Yeah.
But it was But that didn't last long, I must say. It was only with a few groups, and it was, I mean, the one good thing that really, there was the whole Rock Against Racism in England, which really was this sort of organisation set up to sort of counteract racism in the music business, and it had a good effect. You know, there were a lot of good shows, and that really sort of actually squashed any sort of attempts at doing that, you know.
Well, you know, I mentioned that to Ari Up, and she was, because she was back there in that period.
Yeah.
And she talked some of the same things you were saying. She was saying the same thing a lot, and she loved it back then. Great musicians. Well, you were back there when Adrian Sherwood was doing his
Sure, yeah. I actually saw Ari Up in Jamaica last June or so.
Wow.
So, still looking good anyway.
Yeah, well, you know, I interviewed her here, and it was really a great interview, you know, and I just made it into an MP3 file, so I want to actually send it to her, you know.
Right.
Yeah. She sent me a video, actually, and some pictures of her son, you know. She's got a great-looking son, man.
Right, yeah, no.
She's cool. She's cool.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Lots of knowledge, and I want to say this to you, David. You are, I was telling listeners before you called, I said David Corio is going to call, and he is a pictorial historian, but you're an artist too, because there's art in that, in photographing.
Right. Thank you, Charles. Yeah, some people don't appreciate that, but I know you do anyway.
Well, you know, I do a little bit of finagling with cameras too, and sometimes when the pictures don't come out, I look at it and I say, wow. That looks like Can't see his face, but it looks beautiful.
Yeah.
And somebody's telling me, wait a minute, Charles, you got people that try to get those effects.
Right, exactly.
You mean out of focus effects?
And you're doing it without trying. There you go. Just don't start competing, all right, Charles?
No. I won't.
Right.
Listen, you help me and I help you, brother.
Right, sure, yeah. Anyway, I look forward to hearing the show, Charles. Get some music playing anyway. I'm sure they're bored with hearing it.
No, they're not. Because, you know what? 16 years of playing music constantly, it's good to hear people that's involved in the music, such as yourself. So I don't think they're bored, David.
Right.
And then when this will give them something to do when they go out and buy an album on Heartbeat, and we're not bigging up Heartbeat. This is not a commercial for Heartbeat. But they can look at some of the Heartbeat collections and say, let me see. Oh, wow, here's a David Corio pick.
Right.
There's another one. So, hey, listen.
DavidCorio.com, there's a section which I think it says books and assignments, and if you go on that, there's about 100 odd CD.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take your advice, and we're going to put on something. I'm going to let you hear what this is. You tell me what this is, David.
My phone's cutting out.
Can you hear that?
Yeah, it sounds like Diuk, but... Oh, no, I can hear them. Sorry, I can't hear them.
Oh, baby, when I tell you... Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to let them listen, David.
All right, Tom.
And I want to thank you for calling, and we'll talk.
We'll talk soon, yeah.
All right, David.
All right, nice one, Charles.
Bless.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too, right. David.
And happy late birthday, anyway.
Oh, 60. I love it, David. Take care.
All right, bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.